Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon, ready to take your calls if you would like to call with a question that you have about the Bible or the Christian faith, and we can discuss that. Or if you have an alternate viewpoint from the host and want to discuss it, you can use the following phone number. Now, at the moment, our lines are full, but they will not be full for a long time. And so you want to keep this number on hand, because when we talk to some of these people and they've moved along, you can call and occupy the line that they are currently occupying. The number to call will be 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Tom from Monterey, California. Tom, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey,
boy, there's
Steve.
Some loud noise there.
I'm telling you, I think I've got a bad line, so I'll drop my answer or my question to you and see if you can answer it over the phone for me.
Okay.
And number one, when you said that when these calls drop, we'll quickly get to you. Well, I think that most of your answers are rather lengthy, so you should put a little clause in that thing.
Well, that's true.
Anyway,
that's true.
But they're very good answers, I got to tell you. So here's my question to you. Would the Father have to send his Son to die for the sin of Adam and Eve if they didn't disobey him, or any of their offspring ever sinned against God?
All right. Okay. You want me to just take that off the phone?
That'd be great.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
No, I don't believe Jesus would have to die if there was no sin, because the Bible teaches everywhere that he died for the sins of the world, and he died as an atonement for the sins of man. And therefore, if neither Adam nor Eve nor any of their descendants ever sinned, that would not require the remedy. If a person doesn't get sick, they don't need severe remedies for their sickness. So to my mind, the answer is pretty obviously no. Now, there may be some ramifications that I'm not thinking of. Of course, the if Adam and Eve had not sinned premise is one of those what-ifs kind of questions, which obviously do not relate to actual reality, since they did sin. Jesus' death was necessary. The Bible says he was the lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. And if that means that God had already planned for Christ to come and die for the sins of the world at the time that he created the world, it would have to mean that he had anticipated and known that there would be sin to atone for. And yet, if there had been no sin, there would be no reason for Jesus to die. So that'd be my understanding. Now, he would still be the Lord. He would still be our king, but that would not mean that that would be acquired without him coming and dying for our sins, I think, if there were no sins. All right. Tail from Seattle, Washington is next. Tail, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello. It's good to talk to you again. If my question is related to this, I was wondering, how was the death of Jesus Christ a surprise for Satan, since, it's prophesied even in Old Testament, like Psalm 16, right? David is mentioning about Jesus.
You will not leave my soul in Hades, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I hear really often about this. It was a surprise for Satan, because he kind of didn't know what's going to happen. He didn't know Jesus was going to rise from the dead. That's why he
Well, right.
Judah and so forth, yeah. So.
Well, we don't know how much the devil knew in advance. The reason sometimes people say that the devil didn't know that this was going to happen is because of an obscure statement that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, where he said in verse 7 and following, he said, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew. For had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Now, many times it is thought that the rulers of this age is a reference to demonic rulers of the age, Satan and his cohorts. And therefore, Paul says the rulers of this age didn't know the hidden wisdom of God. And if they had known it, they wouldn't have crucified Christ. Now, while it is possible that he is talking about the demonic rulers of this age, because he does use that term in Ephesians 6, where he says, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against rulers of the darkness of this age, and against spiritual wickedness in heavenly places. Paul might have in mind here the demonic hosts as the rulers of this age, but it's not at all necessary to assume this. He could have simply meant that the rulers of the Roman Empire, the human rulers of the age, who did put Christ to death, would not have done so if they had known what God was up to. And therefore, we're not really told specifically that Satan was surprised by this. It may not be Satan that is in view here. That's an unclear thing in the Scripture. Now, it does seem that if Satan had known that Jesus would rise from the dead and thus defeat him, that Satan probably would have no motivation to inspire the Judas to betray Jesus and the mobs to shout for his crucifixion and so forth. And remember, when Jesus was arrested in the garden, he said to Judas and to those who came to arrest him, he said, "This is your hour and the power of darkness," which sounds like it's saying, okay, now I'm being handed over to the powers of darkness to be mistreated and so forth. And that would suggest that the devil was behind it. We know that the devil filled Judas's heart to betray Jesus. So the devil was motivated to kill Jesus. And it doesn't seem like he would have been motivated to if he knew Jesus was going to rise from the dead and conquer him. Now you might say, well, why wouldn't the devil know that Jesus would rise from the dead? You mentioned Psalm 16, which Peter and Paul both quote in their sermons in the book of Acts as being about the second coming, or not about the resurrection of Christ, where he says, "You will not leave my soul in Sheol, neither will you let your Holy One see corruption." Peter in Acts chapter 2 and Paul in Acts 13 both quoted that verse as being about the resurrection of Christ. However, it's not obvious that it's about the resurrection of Christ. We have to remember that Jesus opened his disciples' eyes, their understanding, that they might understand the Old Testament scriptures. And this was after his resurrection. It seems like there were certain mysteries that were hidden from even the disciples. And from,
yeah, because I was about to mention that Jesus even mentioned to the disciples that he will die and the third day will rise again. And
yeah, and yet their ears were kept from understanding it, or their minds were kept from understanding it, the Bible says. And it may be that the devil was kept from understanding it for the same reason.
Yeah, mm-hmm, that's possible. Okay, and one more question, if I may. About the Jesus being crucified on Wednesday, did you hear about that explanation?
I have. I've heard that.
More that he's been 3 days and three nights.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about it?
Well, I think it's a possibility, but I don't know that it can be established beyond question. If it could, then of course Bible scholars would have established it beyond question. There's certainly people have looked into that an awful lot. The problem, of course, is that having Jesus crucified on Friday, which is the traditional date of his crucifixion, makes it impossible to count out 3 days and three nights before his resurrection. And Jesus said in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 40 that as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish or the whale, that the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And that suggests that from the time he was buried until he rose from the dead, that he was in the heart of the earth, and that was for 3 days and three nights. Now, some people have suggested that there was some point earlier than his death that he was considered to be in the heart of the earth. That is, somehow in the hands of the wicked or something like that. But I don't know that certainly doesn't seem like a very natural way to understand it. Of course, if Jesus died on Friday and was buried on Friday before sundown, then Friday would be one day and Friday night one night. Saturday would be the second day, and Saturday night, the second night. But if he rose early Sunday morning, that only gives us 2 days and two nights for him to be in the tomb. And so it's people have suggested maybe he was crucified on Thursday, and others have said Wednesday. If he was crucified on Wednesday, then he'd be Wednesday and Wednesday night, one day. Thursday and Thursday night, 2 days. Friday and Friday night, 3 days. And that seems to be, that seems like he'd have to be rising on Saturday sometime. Now, some people think he may have risen on Saturday, late before sundown, and that he simply remained hidden to his disciples until Sunday, because we read that they came to the tomb around sunrise on Sunday, and it was already empty. So at what point Jesus rose prior to that, we don't know. So that's one theory. Now, the main support for either a Wednesday or a Thursday crucifixion theory is to suggest that the Sabbath, that Jesus was crucified the day before the Sabbath, or the preparation for the Sabbath, that this was not the ordinary weekly Sabbath. Because if it was, well, the weekly Sabbath is Saturday, and the day before that's Friday. So that's where the idea comes from, that Jesus was crucified on Friday, and that's why it's called Good Friday. But the argument is that in addition to the weekly Sabbath, there were additional Sabbaths sprinkled throughout the year, which would fall on various days of the week depending on the year. And this was Passover season. And the Passover, according to the law of Moses, that was a week-long celebration that had a day at the beginning and a day at the end that were both like Sabbaths. You had to do no work on them, just like a Sabbath. And so different years, that week would begin on different days of the week. And some have suggested that that year, the Passover week began on Thursday. And some say it began on Friday. Now, if it began on Thursday and Jesus was crucified at the preparation of the Sabbath, and if Sabbath doesn't mean Saturday, but it means the first day of the Passover celebration, the day before Thursday would be Wednesday. If that Sabbath week began on a Friday that year, then he would have been crucified on a Thursday. These things, people have sought to calculate what year Jesus died, and there's not even certainty among scholars on that. Some say it was the year 30 AD. Some think it was 33 AD, and there are arguments that can be made for either one. But the point is that the year of Jesus' crucifixion would determine what day of the week Passover began that year. And there have been people who've calculated using different beginning points and argued for a Wednesday crucifixion. Some have argued for a Thursday crucifixion. I don't have any problem with the traditional Friday, the tradition of Friday crucifixion, because I believe that Jesus' statement 3 days and three nights, which he used in Matthew 12:40, is an idiom. I don't think it's literal. And by the way, he never used it elsewhere. But such idioms were used among the Jews at the time to mean parts of 3 days, and so he may have meant that. He did say on several occasions that he would be crucified and buried and would rise the third day. Now, that's a different calculation than 3 days and three nights. If he's going to be 3 days and three nights in the tomb and then rise, that's going to be the fourth day, because you've got 3 days and three nights behind you, and now it's got to be the fourth day that he'd rise. So he did say he'd rise on the third day, and he said it numerous times. And even in retrospect, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 said that Christ rose on the third day. So it seems to be the standard teaching of the whole New Testament that Jesus rose on the third day, even though on one occasion he idiomatically said it'd be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. I think he was using that idiom in order to match it to Jonah, because in Jonah chapter 2, we're told that Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish. And I think Jesus was simply trying to make a parallel there, though not being literal in the length of time he was talking about.
Yeah, I just saw today in Luke 24, it kind of makes sense to me, the Wednesday crucifixion. But yep. I saw in Luke 24 where the two disciples were walking, and Jesus appears with them. They're mentioning that today is the third day since those things happened.
That's right.
So, and that was a Sunday.
But
right.
On the other hand, another option that I thought was the three nights, because we don't have three nights over there. I thought that the first night was the 3 hours on the cross when the got dark over there, and then I thought what Genesis says, God named darkness night and then light day. Mm-hmm. And then I thought that could be a first night over there, 3 hours.
Yeah, and you're not the first person to suggest that possibility, too. I mean, some have felt that could be mm-hmm. true also. Although he wasn't in the heart of the earth during that dark spell. He was on the cross. But,
yeah,
you know, if Jesus is speaking somewhat poetically and idiomatically, as he and other Jewish prophets often did, then there wouldn't be any absolute need to press for literalness in the 3 days and three nights. And as I said, and as you observed, when Jesus met them on the road to Emmaus after his resurrection, that was the third day, they said, after his crucifixion. So Friday would be the first day, Saturday the second day, and Sunday would be the third day. So that, you know, this business about the third day seems to support the Friday crucifixion. So there are reasons. There are reasons for that tradition.
Yeah, I thought the woman went to the tomb before the sunrise, and that made, you know, that means Jesus rose before the third day.
Yeah, one of the Gospels says that they were coming to the tomb just before the sun rose, and another Gospel indicates it was right at sunrise, and it's, you know, it's really hard to know exactly what time of day it was. Apparently, it was early enough in the morning that some referred to it as sunrise, and some thought, well, not quite.
Yeah, as you mentioned, those who believe this, they believe that the Passover in that year happened to be on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that argument.
John is mentioning there was a great holiday, so it was an ordinary Sabbath.
It was a high Sabbath, a high day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. high day. Yeah. So that's why it's still not clear. But well, thanks for your explanation, and I got your answers about the Bible translation, ESV and the New King James. Correct? Those are the best.
They're pretty good. Yeah, I like them pretty good.
And then Tyndale Bible Commentary.
Yeah, I like the Tyndale Bible Commentaries. I don't agree with everything in them, of course, but I think they're pretty good.
They're the best around, and as you said, there are multiple authors, right? Not just one
That's right.
writer.
That's right.
And what do you know about Andrew Murray?
Well, Andrew Murray was, I believe, an Anglican, if I'm not mistaken, or was he Dutch Reformed? He might have been Dutch Reformed. I forget now. He was in South Africa and wrote a lot of books of a rather devotional sort for Christians.
On prayer.
On prayer, on humility, on Christ, on waiting on God, on lots of different devotional subjects. And he was very good. Some people really get a lot out of his writings. I really have gotten a lot out of a couple of his books. And others of his books I really haven't really gotten into. And that's not because I found anything objectionable about them. I just found it difficult to get into it. And some people, you know, connect with certain writers more than others. His writings, I think, would be, you know, in some cases comparable with A.W. Tozer's, although I've connected much more readily with A.W. Tozer's writings than Andrew Murray's. But Andrew Murray's a great guy.
He's been recommended along with A.W. Tozer to me, so that's what mm-hmm. I was asking. And the same with Finney, right? Charles Finney?
Finney is inspiring. Finney wrote a systematic theology, and I don't know that I want to recommend his systematic theology, though I'm not critiquing it either. I'm just saying that I don't think he was as much a theologian as he was a revivalist. He was a very powerful revivalist. And mm-hmm. you know, his revival lectures, what's he got, like a journal of his revivals and stuff like that. Those are pretty great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. We'll talk later.
Okay, Teo. Good talking to you. Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Al, calling from Kirkland, Washington. Thanks for waiting, Al. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Steve. I listened to your teachings on Revelation, and you mentioned that the word earth as a world should be translated sometimes as a land. And I was wondering if during the Noah's flood and ark, there's a lot of times the word earth used. Is that, do you think, used as a land or the whole world?
Well, there one of the arguments people give for a local flood instead of a global flood is the fact that the Hebrew word for earth, which is in the Hebrew, it's eretz, is the word. It can also be translated the land. Sometimes it means, you know, in some contexts, just the land mass of a certain region. And so when the Bible says that the floodwaters covered the whole earth or the whole eretz, it could technically, as far as the word itself, the flexibility of the word itself, it could mean the whole land area. And some people think that the flood was only locally in a certain land area that was all covered with water, but not the whole planet Earth. And as far as the meaning of the words go, that is a possibility. I do believe, though, that there's quite a few other considerations that make me believe that the flood was global. That is, it covered the whole planet. But if we're left only to use the word eretz and decide its meaning, we could go either way on it.
What are your other considerations for global?
One of them is that the waters covered the highest mountains for 22 and a half feet above the tops of the mountains. Now, and it took a year. When the water stopped coming out of the sky, when it stopped raining, it took almost a year for the waters to subside enough for Noah and his family to come out. And if this was a local flood in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley or something like that, there could be a great flood that would, you know, kill everybody and all the animals in the region. But for it to cover all the mountains, and stay at that height for months and months would not be explicable in terms of a local flood, because local floods, once the rain stops, they start draining off. If the waters are higher than the mountains, there's no natural barriers to keep them from going down. Even if they weren't higher than the mountains and they just had to drain off into valleys and things like that, it still wouldn't take months and months and months, a year, for the water to go away. It was several months before the ark, before the waters even went down low enough that the hull of the ark touched the top of a mountain, and they still couldn't see mountaintops for some months after that. So, in other words, if it was a local flood, we do know something about local floods. First of all, they can't be kept very local if the mountains, which are to contain them, are covered with water 22 and a half feet above the mountaintops. And then if there is a local flood, you're not going to have the mountains invisible because they're covered with water for many months after the flood, after the raining has stopped. Those are important factors, I think. There are others. I mean, one of them was that Noah seemed to have 120 years advance notice about the flood and built an ark. But actually, he could have just escaped. In 120 years, he could have just left that valley. If the flood's going to be local, God could have had all the animals go out of that valley just as easily as he had them come to the ark. And he could have had Noah not have to build the ark and just leave. Now, some people say, well, that's true, but God wanted him to build the ark as a witness to people, or as a witness against people. Well, there's a possibility of that. But none of the people got saved, and I don't know if that's a good economy of the time, but God's certainly entitled to do it. God knows what he wants to accomplish. But it seems to me that if God is just going to flood a valley, he could just tell Noah and his family to get out. Just like, for example, when he was destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, he didn't tell Lot to build an asbestos dome, you know, for his family. He just told him to get out of here because this place is going to be wiped out. If the disaster was local, God's servants could be warned and escaped. As, for example, when Jerusalem was going to be destroyed in AD 70, and God warned the church in Jerusalem to flee, and they fled out of Jerusalem, so they missed that horrible judgment. So there are other reasons, but I mean, those are some of the ones that come to mind. Of course, the rainbow, seems to be a reminder that God would never flood the earth again. But if the earth just means the land area where people live. There's been lots of floods that have flooded land areas before. So the rainbow would not be telling a true story if every time the rainbow shows up, it's a promise that God won't do right. this again. But if it was only a local flood, he's done it many times before and since.
Mm-hmm.
Those factors just make me think it's no doubt, a global flood. The things that make it difficult to believe in a global flood are, a lot of people say there's not enough water to cover the earth. Even if you would condense all the water in the atmosphere into liquid water, it still wouldn't cover the earth. But that's taking the earth's topography as it is now. I mean, one reason the waters stay in the seas and don't cover the earth is because the seabed is so deep in certain places. And of course, there's mountains that are very high on the continents. But if the land shape, was altered at the time of the flood, and mountains rose and seabeds sank, which is not impossible to imagine. In fact, we would expect topography to change considerably if the fountains of the Great Deep are breaking up and all the land is underwater for a year. I mean, water does erode, especially anything that's not solid rock and even rock. And then if there's seismic activity going along with it, there could be tectonic plates shifting. There could be new mountain ranges forming. There could be new valleys in the oceans forming. In any case, all the water that's in the world could certainly cover the earth if the mountains were slightly smaller and the seabeds were slightly shallower in those days. If the extremities have increased since then we don't know how difficult it would be to cover the whole earth with the amount of water that we even see around us now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think the mountain that the Ark landed, the mount, I think it's called Ararat, I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Yeah, it says it's the mountains of Ararat. There is a mountain in Turkey or Armenia called Ararat today, but Ararat was a region which no doubt was in Armenia, and it says the Ark landed in the mountains of Ararat. So we don't know if it was the individual mountain that we call Mount Ararat today or if it was just one of the other mountains in the region.
Mm, but you believe it was there in Turkey as we know today?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's the area where it was. Yeah, and I don't know if it's there now. There have been, books written by people who claim that they've gone hiking up there and they say they've seen it. There's alleged aerial photographs of it that have been taken by pilots. The problem with it is that those mountains are covered with ice and snow most of the year, and it's hard to know what's under there. But sometimes the snow melts off enough, and some people claim they've seen, a portion of the Ark or something sticking out, and then it gets covered over again with the next blizzard or avalanche. So, I can't really say if it's still up there or not. But if it's not, it's not a problem to me. In fact, I'd be very surprised if it was there, only because after the flood, you would think that milled lumber would be of great value for building houses. And there was a ton of milled lumber in that boat.
Mm. That's true. Interesting. Well, okay, thanks so much, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay, good talking to you, Al. Thanks for your call.
Thanks,
have a good day. Bye now. All right, Victor from Seattle, Washington is next. Victor, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, great. Thanks, Steve. You could do the answer off the air. I just wanted to comment on the gentleman who asked about the devil knowing about Jesus' crucifixion. And
yeah.
Sometimes I would, I'm thinking of the fruit, because the devil represents the antithesis of the fruits of the Spirit: patience, self-control, love, and so forth. And when I think, let's say, a swindler, a murderer, they have, even though they may know the truth, they don't opt to do the truth, to act upon the truth. And I thought, maybe, is it possible, if you've ever thought about that, that the devil, maybe he did know the future, he knew what was going to happen, he knew the Bible, but when he got that temptation to kill Christ, he just gave in because that's his nature. Now, I can take this off the air and wherever this discussion leads it to.
Okay, Victor. Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Well, I don't know what the devil knew and what he didn't know. I will say that sometimes it seems that the demons in the Bible, when they react, act very, let's just say, inconveniently for themselves. For example, there are demon-possessed people in the Bible who seem to behave very nicely most of the time until they're in the presence of Jesus and they start going berserk and the demons manifest themselves. You'd think that they'd be better off not manifesting themselves in the presence of Jesus, because it invariably led to him casting them out, which is not what they wanted. You'd think they would lie low and wait till he'd passed, you know, and yet they seem to act against their own best interests, perhaps very irrationally, when they saw him. And who knows, if the demons do that, maybe the devil's irrational like that too. I mean, I can't really say. He could have acted out, you know, against his best interests, even even knowingly in some respects. Lots of people do that when they sin. I mean, a person who goes out and gambles or goes out and has an affair or goes out and gets drunk, and when they know they're driving home, they know they're taking a risk to themselves. They might even know, this is I'm going to be sorry for this tomorrow. This is going to be something this is going to ruin my life, but I want to do it right now. And sin is a strange bondage, and Satan, being the ultimate sinner, perhaps, you know, like you said, he was just tempted to murder. He's a murderer from the beginning, Jesus said. And so he took advantage of Jesus, even though he may have in the back of his mind thought, well, I'm going to enjoy this at the moment, but this is going to hurt me later. I don't know. We just don't know what was going on in the devil's mind. But your suggestion is an interesting one. I guess I'd have to say it's not impossible to imagine the scenario you're talking about. Let's talk to Chai from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Yeah, Jesus was talking. He was talking about binding a strong man.
Yeah,
in your understanding, when did he actually binding Satan?
When did he bind Satan? That's a good question. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus spoke. When he was accused of casting out demons by the power of the devil, he said, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. You know, that makes the devil being the one casting out the devil. But he said, no one can enter into a strong man's house and plunder his house unless he first binds the strong man, and then he will plunder his house. Now, that's in Matthew 12:29. And what he's saying, of course, is that Satan... Satan's house is being plundered by Jesus. That's what casting demons out of people exhibited. These people had been Satan's house. They had been his possessions in his house, in his domain. And Jesus was releasing them, stealing them from Satan. And he says, you can't do that to a strong man unless you first bind him. And what Jesus is saying is that, obviously, if I'm plundering the devil's house, I must have bound him. He must be bound, or else he would stop me from doing this, and he can't. Now, you say, when was Satan bound?
Yes.
Well, the Bible isn't really explicit on that, because actually there are some things in the Bible that indicate that when Jesus died and rose again, that this was a signal defeat of Satan. In Colossians 2:15, it says that he disarmed principalities and powers and made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in the cross. Although in some manuscripts it says triumphing over them in him, that is perhaps just Jesus himself coming to earth was the triumph. We know the devil was very afraid when Jesus was coming, because the book of Revelation depicts the dragon as just waiting for the birth of the man child so that he can kill him right away. And we know that Herod, no doubt inspired by Satan, sought to kill Jesus when he was an infant, but he escaped. Satan seemed to be very much afraid of what Jesus was coming to do, and wanted to kill him. And it may be that the very presence of Jesus preaching publicly is what bound the strong man. After all, we have to ask, what does it mean for Satan to be bound? What's his main activity? Well, the Bible always says that Satan's main activity is to deceive the world. He's a liar and the father of lies. He deceives the whole world, the Bible says. Well, Jesus came, and what did he do? He started preaching the truth. And Jesus said, if you continue in my words, you're my disciples indeed, and you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free from Satan. And Satan would not be able to keep people bound anymore. And there's a sense in which the binding of Satan could be an image of the undoing of the works of the devil that Jesus did both in his ministry and in his death and resurrection. It says in 1 John 3:8 that for this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might undo the works of the devil. And I think that Jesus started undoing the works of the devil even before his death. And at his death and resurrection, I think that was the coup de grace, you know, inflicted on the devil. But I think that the whole time Jesus was on the earth, especially when he's preaching, what's he bringing? He's bringing light. He's bringing truth. And the devil, the devil's power is the power of deception and darkness. And so there's a sense in which the devil's power was neutralized. Satan, we could say, figuratively speaking, was bound. He couldn't resist and couldn't hold on to what he had when Christ was there preaching. So it may be that the very entrance of Jesus into the world or the very beginning of his preaching should be seen as the beginning of Satan being bound, but the Bible doesn't really shed a specific light on the time of that.
Okay, sounds good. One more question.
Yeah.
I'm really have difficult time in spending time, quiet time, or in prayer.
Uh-huh.
Do you have anything to recommend that I can practice?
Well, I'll tell you, it's hard in our hurried, fast-paced society to get time alone and to even find quiet place. I don't know if you live with other people or live alone, or what's going on in your house when you're there. Lots of people have music playing all the time, or the TV on all the time, or there's just people around talking and coming and going, and you know, it's really hard. Jesus got up a long time before daylight and went out to a private place to pray. And I don't think Jesus is a person who'd have a real hard time concentrating in his prayers. But even he found it necessary to get away from people. And there were two things he did. One is he found a time of day where there weren't many people around before daylight. And two, he went out to a remote place where there weren't many people to be encountered for these. And I think the Bible indicates this was Jesus' regular habit. So there is something to be said, at the very least, for finding privacy, whether it's a private time when no one else is going to be around or a private place, but being alone with God. And then, of course, even then, these days, we've got so many things racing through our heads. We've got the music we've been listening to not long ago, the movie we last saw, or the television program, or a jingle from a commercial, or, you know, we've got, you know, what we've got to do later today on our mind. A lot of times when we try to pray, we get the impression that, well, I better get this over with because I got a lot to do today, you know, so I'll just kind of rush through this, make sure I do my duty. And yet I think for prayer time to be very fruitful and to have a regular prayer life that's very, very productive, it's valuable to have unhurried time. Like even if you just said, okay, no matter what, I'm going to give this hour to pray. Now, I don't know what I'll pray for, but if my mind tells me I need to get about my business, I'll just look at my watch and say, nope, not time yet. Not time for my business. I just need to pray. But I think it's also helpful to pray with the Bible open, though Jesus, of course, couldn't do that. He didn't have a Bible. But a lot of people have found it helpful to pray with the Bible open, to read some scripture, and then let those scriptures suggest to you things that you need to pray about. I would suggest that praying the Lord's Prayer is a good idea. At least it's been a good idea for me. It's a very short prayer, but it's sort of a skeletal prayer. It sort of has basic themes, which you let each of the lines in the prayer suggest to you a broader theme of the kingdom of God, or of your material needs, or if you're trying to overcome temptation. I mean, these are the things that come up in that prayer, and you don't have to just race through that prayer. You can just use that as the skeletal structure for your praying. And then other people have said, I know that Elizabeth Elliot said that prayer is work. It probably isn't always work, but if you're going to do it regularly and diligently, you're going to have to do it at times when you'd rather do something else, where you'd rather just, you know, vegetate, or you'd rather stay in bed, or you'd rather just be entertained. and you know, just like you'd rather do those things than get up and mow the lawn or clean the garage. You know, you got to see prayer as a worthy work that produces something. And E.M. Bounds, who wrote several books on prayer, said that prayer is the manliest work that a human being can do, because it's cooperating with God in the rulership of the world. It's basically asking God to do this and that thing in his rulership of the world, which he's invited us and given us permission to ask him to do. And so, in a sense, a person who prays well probably does more to change the world than one who does any other kind of good work. So you've got to see the value in what you're doing. Of course, that takes faith, because usually you'll pray for something and you won't immediately see response. Sometimes you'll pray for the same thing every day for years and you won't see the response. And obviously, that's going to make you start thinking, well, should I even keep praying for this? And your faith begins to be shaken. But Jesus said, in I think it's in Luke 18:1, that men ought always to pray and to never lose heart. He told a parable about the persistent widow, or it was the one about the man knocking his neighbor's door. But basically, he told a prayer that was to get across the idea that men ought always to pray and never to faint, never to lose heart. And we do a lot more fainting than praying, I think. If we don't see answers to our prayers right away, we're used to, you know, getting stuff immediately. You know, we have fast food, we've got the ATMs machines, we can go online. And if our computer takes 3 seconds to load the page, we're frustrated, we want to tear our hair out. I can't wait 3 seconds for the page load. How come this computer's so slow? We're just impatient people because we've been conditioned to get quick responses to things. And God is not thoroughly modern. He hasn't changed his ways. He's not necessarily in a hurry. And we are. And that's where we, when we want to have a life of prayer, are going to have to learn some patience and learn that God's time is not always, you know, as quick as we want it to be. But he does want us to continue praying and not faint. And so a lot of that has to do with our attitude toward praying, but also there's the logistics of it. Making a prayer list is a great idea. Now, I'm telling you to do some things that I don't do, but I wish I did. I think that when someone says, please pray for me about this or that, and people say that to me all the time, I try to pray for them right away, but I should really put it on a list. The trouble is I just don't have a list, you know, a notepad with me most of the time, and I just don't do it. I'm not disciplined to it. But I think it'd be better, certainly if you're going to spend an hour in prayer in the morning, it would help a great deal to have a list of the things you're going to pray for. Otherwise, there's a tendency to have to fight off a wandering mind.
Okay, thank you. That's good.
Okay, Chai, thanks for your call.
Have a good day.
You too. God bless you. All right, Daryl from Sacramento, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I got a question about the Law of Moses.
Okay.
If when a person uses any part of the Mosaic Law, is he practicing legalism? How so?
Well, what do you mean any part of the Mosaic Law? You mean the rituals of the law?
No, like a dress code or something.
Well, I'm not really sure of a dress code in the Mosaic Law, except that the Mosaic Law said a man should not wear what pertains to a woman, and a woman should not wear what pertains to a man.
Right.
And there were special garments for the priests. But apart from that, there's a blue, if someone's going to wear a blue hem around their robe, first of all, I'm not sure why they're wearing a robe nowadays, but if they have a robe and they've got a blue hem around the bottom, that's probably legalistic. I mean, it's a Jewish custom. Is there something specific you have in mind? Because there are some things in Jewish law that Christians are not required to do because they're ceremonial, but which are okay if someone wants to. For example, in 1 Corinthians 14, Paul said one man esteems one day above another. Another man esteems every day alike. Let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. So some people want to keep a Sabbath. Some people don't. And Paul said, well, it's okay. Don't judge each other. Same thing about diet. He said one man, his conscience lets him eat anything. Others, because of their tender conscience, can't eat everything. And certainly Jews would be like that in their religion. They can't eat everything because some things are forbidden. But Paul said, don't judge each other about those things. So, I mean, there is a sense in which it might be legalistic for a person to say, well, I can't allow myself to eat pork or shellfish because that's against the law of Moses. Or that they feel like they have to keep holy days. There's a sense in which that can be legalistic. It's not necessarily an evil thing for someone to do that, but it may not be the healthiest thing for them spiritually, because legalism is not really the same thing as spirituality.
Okay, so here's the thing. If it's not mentioned in the Old Testament with an A or yea, is it okay? I mean, if it's not mentioned in the New Testament, it's okay if it's the law in the Old Testament.
Well, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. The Bible doesn't say anything directly about deforestation of rainforests, but there's a general principle that we need to be good stewards of what God has given us, and so one might argue that Christians should not be favorable toward denuding the rainforests, and it's not a good investment in the future of our next generation, and so forth. But it's not specifically mentioned in the Bible.
What about washings?
Washings? Now, the only washings that the Bible actually commands in the Old Testament are washings at the end of a period of defilement.
Yeah.
Like if you've touched a dead body, or you've had a wet dream, or you've been with a woman on her period, then, or you are a woman on her period, then those are periods of defilement. And at the end of those times, washing the hands and the body and the clothes were part of the ceremony. I don't think those laws of uncleanness are still relevant, but we actually have other reasons to wash ourselves that they didn't know about. We know about hygiene, and we know that sometimes you can contract illness or whatever, and we should wash our hands probably more than we do in some cases. But no, there's nothing wrong with a person washing himself, but if he becomes obsessive about it, then he's probably distracted from being a Christian, and he's probably more thinking of being Jewish.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Steve.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Daryl.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay. I think it's Travis from Everett, Washington. Bye-bye. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Okay. I had a question about the comment earlier about the Ark.
Uh-huh.
And you guys were talking about it being on Mount Ararat, on the mountain itself. It's not a mountain, it's in the valley in Turkey. Ron Wyatt found the Ark.
Oh, I've read Ron Wyatt's stuff. Yeah, I know about his stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he found it from satellite. Exact dimensions of the boat, everything. They found metals, they dug on the outside of the boat, and I was just wondering why people are still thinking that it's on Mount Ararat when it's in the valley at the bottom of the mountain, not on the top.
Well, not everybody believes that Ron Wyatt found the Ark.
Well, I've seen the diggings and the artifacts, and the Turkish government and everything out there documented it and proved it to be the Ark.
Have you been there?
Well, that's kind of old news now.
Yeah, I know I read about it back in the 80s, but have you actually been over to Turkey?
I've seen what they've shown on video and pictures, and it's the exact dimensions of the boat. They dug around the outside of the boat, exact dimensions as Noah got from God, and the metals inside the boat and the compartments. It's the boat. I mean,
There certainly is a possibility that the Ark, after it had landed on the mountains, slid down the mountainside into the valley.
That's what I'm thinking, but it was so dug down in the earth that they had to excavate it, and it took almost a half a year to dig around the side of the boat. But I just kind of wanted to clear that up, that it's not on the mountain, it's down in the valley. That's all I really wanted to comment on.
Okay, Travis. Well, one thing you need to know is that there have been several books written by people who claim that they've seen the Ark, that they touched it, that they walked around inside of it, and things like that, or that it was seen from the air. And most of them place it up on the Mount Ararat. Now, Ron Wyatt is one of the people who claims that he's found the Ark. I haven't been to his archaeological dig. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen pictures. I've seen videos. I've not been to Turkey. I haven't seen the real thing in front of my eyes. And
yeah.
All I'm saying is that what he's claiming about it is different than what some other people claim who say they've seen the Ark.
Well, they had the Turkish government out there and documented it and everything. They had a bunch of people out there around the mountain. Ron Wyatt also was the first to discover
the Ark of the Covenant. I know, yeah.
Not just that, but he also found the mountain, Noah, Moses' mountain in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I know. I agree that it's in Saudi Arabia, yeah.
Saudi Arabia in Jabal Lahaz.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's just an ordinary guy with just had a few bucks in his pocket, and God, you know, it's pretty amazing. He used an ordinary man to find these. He's not an expert on archaeology or anything, but it's just pretty amazing. He batted 3 out of 3, and, you know, kind of amazing he was able to find these things.
Yeah, Ron Wyatt is, of course, dead now, and I can't talk to him.
Sad to hear that.
Yeah, but... His work is controversial, and there's people who swear by it, and there's people who say that it's not reliable. But I'm not an archaeologist, and I haven't been to Turkey, and I haven't been over to Saudi Arabia either. So I haven't seen any of these things, but I've seen videos, and you know, of course, anything can be done on video. You know, I've watched aliens invade this planet on movies, on videos too, but. But the point is that I you know, he's a controversial guy. It's maybe his stuff is good stuff. I don't stand by it or against it.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
It sounds like you're not hearing me very well, so I think we'll move along. But thanks for your call. Let's talk to Dena from Seattle, Washington. Welcome, Dena.
It's Dina, actually.
Dina. Okay. Yeah. My call screen didn't know how to spell Dina. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. You've probably answered this question for other people before, but I was reading about Cain killing Abel, and then Cain was sent out from the presence of the Lord.
Yeah.
And he put a mark on him so that if anyone found him, and I'm thinking, what anyone? Would those obviously had to be his future brothers and sisters, right?
Well, not even his future ones, but the ones that were living at the time. You have to realize that Cain killed Abel once they were adults. And Adam and Eve were having kids the whole time. When God made Adam and Eve, he told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. We read about them having Cain and then Abel. And then we read about a story that took place when Cain and Abel were adults. Now, there's no reason to believe that Adam and Eve just had two sons and waited for those sons to grow up before they had any more kids. I'm not sure how they would prevent it. They didn't have birth control, and God had commanded them to fill the earth. So I believe that they were having a lot of kids. We just don't know their names because their stories are not told. But the story of Cain and Abel is told. And Cain and Abel were apparently almost 130 years old when Cain killed Abel. We know that. Because when Cain killed Abel, another son was born to Eve, and she named him Seth. And she said, the word Seth means appointed, because she says, God has appointed me another son to replace Cain, to replace Abel, whom Cain slew. So Cain had apparently just slain Abel recently, and Seth was the next son born and was seen as the one that God appointed to replace Abel, who had been slain. But Adam and Eve were 130 years old when Seth was born. So that would suggest that when Cain killed Abel, Adam and Eve, and therefore Cain and Abel, were almost 130 years old. And during that time, a lot of kids were no doubt born to them. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I appreciate your call. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills and keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.